Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
On April 24th, 1925, a high school teacher named John Scopes taught a class in Dayton, Tennessee, using a state-mandated textbook that included a chapter explaining Darwin's theory of evolution. In doing so, Scopes was in violation of Tennessee's Butler Act, passed earlier that year. Scopes was arrested, tried, convicted, and fined $100. The verdict was later overturned on a technicality, but the case has gone down in history as an example of faith against science, ignorance against knowledge, and tradition against progress. This conception of the Scopes trial was only reinforced by the famous 1960 film Inherit the Wind, starring Gene Kelly and Spencer Tracy, among many others. But that version of the story is too simple. The real story of how the Scopes trial came about and why it came about is far more interesting and intriguing, and it shows us complications and conflicting motives of all those who were involved. Hello, Buzzkillers. It's your favorite professor here, and I'm here with another one of my favorite professors, Professor Phil Nash from Penn State University, and he's going to help us talk about the Scopes trial in 1925. How are you, Professor?
I'm doing swell. Thanks for having me on.
Can you, well, it's great to have you here. It's always great to have you here. Can you give us some sort of a setting of what the chronological setting and also the sort of milieu of what's going on in 1925 in the U.S. when this trial starts to crank up?
Right. Well, I think a big picture. Often these sorts of events are properly seen as reaction to rapid change, and obviously change, the one constant in history is change, but the pace of change by the 1920s seemed very, very fast for a lot of people. This is a time when the United States is, well, of course, it's called the Roaring Twenties for a bunch of reasons, but you have these very, very sharp conflicts because the country is modernizing very quickly. It's urbanizing very quickly. We've just had this sort of massive influx of immigrants in the late 19th, early 20th century. Huge numbers before World War One seemed to change the character of the country. If you're a native-born white, it seemed to change it in a lot of bad ways. You have a lot of these major fault lines in American society, which always exist, like urban versus rural and religion versus science, and in the 20s, wet versus dry on the issue of prohibition, sort of modernity versus tradition. And all these things are a very important backdrop to the Scopes trial.
Okay, and people can even see these changes within their own lifetimes.
Well, absolutely.
Because cars are now riding around.
Automobiles are common. Things like refrigerators, electricity, telephones, automobiles, like you said, are no longer a luxury item. And the important pattern in U.S. history, I think, to see here is that we go through these periodic religious revivals, and those are like the Great Awakening in the 18th century and the Second Great Awakening in the 19th century. These are often, in part, reactions to rapid social change. And so in the 1920s, you have this sort of another surge of fundamentalist Protestantism. Which it's not the first time in U.S. history, won't be the last, but it's, and you know, it never entirely goes away,
right?
And never completely takes over, but it sort of comes and goes. Well, and it's coming very strongly in the 1920s.
What's so fascinating about this is that's the way this Scopes trial is usually presented as the clash of progress against tradition and all that sort of stuff. But essentially, what we found and what we're going to tell the Buzzkillers is that the trial itself was a publicity stunt cooked up by the city fathers of Dayton, which was a relatively small town at the time.
That's right. Yeah. And that's, and you know, when I looked at this was sort of a surprise to me, that, you know, I always learned that it was basically a story of the ACLU looking for the brand new ACLU, by the way, the American Civil Liberties Union, looking for a test case against this new law that Tennessee had passed banning the teaching of evolution in the schools. But actually, it's a little more prosaic and a little more interesting than that, because there is this fellow, a sort of a manager of a local coal company in Dayton, Tennessee. Dayton, Tennessee, a sort of small town of about 6,000 people in the 1920s in southeastern Tennessee. He's sort of one of the city fathers, George Rapelier. He's a manager of a local coal company. He sort of calls together some of the sort of bigwigs in town, and they sort of brainstorm how they are going to basically boost the town. How are they going to aid it financially? How are they going to sort of do something to help put it on the map, attract some attention, maybe attract some business. And
this new law, the Tennessee State Legislature, whatever, passes the Butler Act.
The Butler Act, right.
Which forbids the teaching of evolution in March, right?
Right.
1925.
That's right.
Yeah, so after the law comes into effect, this brand new ACLU that you're talking about offers to pay the legal expenses of any Tennessee teacher who's willing to challenge the law. And that's why these town fathers sort of get together, or at least
right.
a few of them get together. What do they decide to do?
They decide that there's a local teacher, John Scopes, mm-hmm. who will not really serve as the ACLU's test case, but as their own test case. In other words, they will sort of prosecute him, and or they'll have the local legal authorities prosecute him, and then that will attract attention to the town.
Oh.
That's their plan. So... I was going to say, I mean, in the big picture, I think this story retains its sort of symbolic importance. And I think most historians for a long, long time always looked at this as being of symbolic importance
right.
rather than of practical importance.
Okay.
And we can get to some of the practical importance later. But, you know, it's really important that people understand that there's this much more sort of, I don't want to say base, but sort of mundane explanation behind this famous trial.
And what really behind why it happened, when it happened, and where it happened.
Exactly. Right. Because this conceivably could have happened someplace else.
Right.
And there's nothing unique about Dayton in that sense. Like, imagine mm-hmm. all sorts of small town fathers all over the place scheming how to promote their towns.
Right. I wonder if we don't know this, there's no evidence, but I wonder if Rapelier and these other town leaders thought, you know, this is the age of the telegraph, this is the age of the radio, even big stations like WGN were able to broadcast nationwide and things like that. I wonder if they thought, you know, we ought to jump on this bandwagon
right.
while we can, because that's one way we can get more attention.
Right. Which also is an interesting thing, too, now that I think about this, because this is often portrayed, like I did a minute ago, as sort of rural versus urban.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, this is a quote-unquote rural area, a small town with very big town thinking. Right?
Yeah, that's
right?
true.
How do we make use of modern media? How do we sort of cash in? How do we, in effect... get into the new business of advertising, which is another thing in the 1920s,
right?
With radio and in print. This is sort of the golden age of advertising. This is when advertising as a field really starts taking off.
Yes, yeah, it's not at all clear, but it may be that if this had happened in 1905 or 1915, you know, it wouldn't have been as big a splash
exactly
because media
right.
and transportation
exactly
was
right.
expensive. Yeah, so anyway, so they have this meeting, they call in this teacher named John Scopes, and what do they ask him to do?
They ask him to sort of to agree to be prosecuted under this new law. And the problem is that he doesn't know for sure whether he violated the law. He was just sort of, as we would say today, teaching to the standards, right? He's teaching in a public school. He sort of saw himself as doing his job. He did not see himself, as far as I know, as any sort of great renegade or leading the charge or anything. And so he's so uncertain that he actually sort of asks some of the local folks just come and sit in on his class to sort of observe him teaching to see whether he actually violated the law.
Yeah, because he's teaching out of a standard issue, in fact, a mandated textbook.
That's right.
And it explains the evolutionary theory. It gives a sort of a chart of it, but he can't actually say in all honesty to this sitting group of city fathers, you know, well, I promoted evolution.
Right.
He can say, I explained it as it was explained in the book.
Right. Well, and that's another part of the important context, too, is that by the 1920s, you finally see sinking in nationwide what's been going on for decades, and that is the trend toward universal, mandatory, publicly funded education,
mm-hmm.
which was not at all the story in the early 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes decades to percolate throughout the country. And so you start to see all kids required to go to school on the taxpayer's dime,
mm-hmm.
and then you merge that with sort of the era of modern science, not only Darwin, but all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
And then even in small towns, you basically see the sort of quote-unquote modern scientific world invading, if you look at it that way, even these small towns, and that's where you start to see a lot of pushback.
Right. Some of the fundamentalists in Dayton and in other places would have thought of that as an invasion.
That's
and
right.
that's certainly the way it's promoted or presented, I should say, in the trial, not in the trial, but in the play and in the movie later on. We'll get to that in a minute. But what I thought was so interesting about what the Institute researchers here have come up with is they have a quote that apparently Scopes said in response to this request. He said, "If you can prove that I've taught evolution, that I qualify as a defendant, that I'm willing to stand trial." So he's like, they say, "Hey, are you willing to be part of this sort of put up job that we're doing? And he says yes.
Right.
I can't imagine why.
Right.
Except maybe he just was thought it was a good thing for the town.
Right. And then, and once again, in a totally different context from what I, not that I'm an expert on this, but that I learned years ago, my take on this was that this same exercise is taking place, but under the auspices of the ACLU.
Right.
The ACLU is looking for the equivalent of a Rosa Parks type figure.
Uh-huh.
In other words, will you be our sort of sacrificial lamb? And no, not at all. It's not the ACLU gets involved, obviously, and they do pay his legal expenses, but they're playing catch up. It's the local sort of, well, I don't want to say hucksters, the local promoters,
right,
who are sort of creating this effort and trying to get him on board. And so, in other words, he doesn't see himself as, oh, sure, I'll lead the charge for sort of scientific righteousness
and enlightenment.
Yeah, and enlightenment. Yeah, no, I'll lead the charge. I'll go along if the town wants to promote itself, which is a very, very different take.
Well, and we don't know this, and we have to be careful about speculating, but clearly it seems that the ACLU's offer to pay the legal fees after the Butler law is passed, the anti-evolution law is passed, may have prompted the Rappelier and these town leaders to then think, oh, we need to make use of this.
That's right.
And also Scopes must have thought, I mean, again, I hate to speculate, buzzkillers, that's where myths start, but he must have thought, well, this is obviously a setup job. I'm not actually going to go to the slammer.
Right.
So anyways, they all agree to go ahead with the plan. Scopes then teaches it again to his students on April 24th and he's arrested.
Right. And then what ensues is trial of the century.
The trial of the century.
Or not.
What I found was so interesting is between his indictment and between the actual trial, Scopes himself talks to his students because he knows that they're going to be part of the trial. They're going to be witnesses. And he coaches them up. Remember when we said
right,
everyone
exactly.
Would,
right.
You know, he's basically, you know, convicting himself, and he helps
right,
him prepare their testimony.
Would you testify against me, please?
And
that
so,
normally doesn't happen, I'm thinking.
I know. So even in this very early stage, before all the reporters show up and all this sort of stuff, it's being planned, and the kind of media blitz is being planned because he's telling these students what to say.
Right. Well, and then the promotion machine doesn't stop at that point because then Rappelier and people like that realize that really to keep this, to get this engine going faster, they need to bring in sort of high-priced help. In other words, the local attorneys are not going to do it. In fact, the promoters even wrote to, of all people, the British novelist H.G. Wells.
Oh, famous science writer, among other things.
Yeah, among other things, to ask him to be on the defense team. He declined, partly because he was not licensed to practice law in the United States. minor detail. Sure, I'm a great lawyer. No, I can't practice.
Can you imagine they'd have to ship him over,
exactly.
And by the time he got there,
it would have been harvest time
and everyone would have forgotten.
So he did turn down one job. In any case, so they used their connections with some of the sort of national religious organizations to recruit none other than the prairie populist, William Jennings Bryan. For your listeners, this was one of the most famous Democratic politicians of his age, three-time failed presidential candidate, Secretary of State under Wilson, famous public lecturer on the downside of his life, actually, as it turns out, in the 1920s, but very sort of famous, devout Christian, right, sort of fundamentalist. They bring him in to be the prosecutor.
I mean, he's also, though, I mean, this sounds contradictory now to people in the 21st century because so many fundamentalist Christian political organizations are also very conservative in terms of social and political reform. But Bryan was the opposite. He was a champion of women's rights and voting and things like that, and a big social reformer, but he was a hardcore Christian.
Right. He was the original populist. In fact, something I found out about this, which I found interesting, is his opposition to Darwinism in particular. And this is important context, too, is that he objected to what in the late 19th, early 20th century was sort of the perversion of Darwinism we know as social Darwinism.
Oh, yes. Right.
In other words, and this was used to justify all sorts of things, including, well, Hitler was a big social Darwinist.
Yep.
Right. In other words, you pervert this science and impose it on humans, and then it justifies inequality and brutality and all these other things.
And even eugenics.
Yeah. And so he was a big opponent for not so much well, I'm sure he opposed it on religious grounds, but also on political grounds about how it was used and abused. And so, in other words, he felt like this was, you had opened a can of worms with Darwinism, so it shouldn't be taught.
Okay. So then, you got Brian, this huge person, a huge figure on the one side, a very, very famous figure. And then remember, Buzzkillers, the ACLU, immediately after the Butler Act had been passed, promised that they would help fund the defense of any teacher who challenged the act. And so they brought in their own ACLU lawyers, but they also convinced Clarence Darrow, probably the most famous defense attorney in American history, right?
Yes, pretty much.
To join the defense team, and he eventually says yes.
Yep. And by the way, I should mention an unrelated book here. There's a book called Arc of Justice out there, which is about the trial of a black doctor in Detroit who basically violently defended his house and killed a white person, or he and his group killed a white person, and there was a big trial at the time, and Darrow was also involved in that, and he was acquitted. It's by Kevin Boyle, I think. It's called Arc of Justice. It's a great book. Anyway,
so yes. Darrow's by far, he's a champion of the, he sees himself as a champion of the underdog.
That's right.
He's
And I can't think of another defense attorney who has a bigger reputation in that period, or maybe not in American history. But yeah, that's a great get for the ACLU, no question.
Right, right. So they've got basically the two of the most famous people in the country coming.
Yeah, and that, in terms of the setup of the trial, this could not have gone better for the town if you're trying to attract attention, and that certainly works out if you look at the media storm that is generated by this.
What were Brian, we know Brian was a hardcore Christian. What was Darrow?
Darrow, as far as I understand, was basically an agnostic.
Oh.
So in that sense, it's a nice sort of media rivalry as well, right? I mean, the lines are pretty clearly drawn.
Right. And it's probably unlikely, but we don't know, that if they had just used the ordinary ACLU lawyers, ordinary, I shouldn't say, but also the ordinary prosecutors, that the national press would have come in. I've got some fantastic stats here that I read out to the Buzzkillers. You know, Rapelier and these Dayton civic leaders certainly were smart enough. They weren't country bumpkins. They knew what they were doing. They eventually got these titans to come in. 200 national newspapers and 2 London newspapers sent correspondents to Dayton. And this is, as you say, in rural Tennessee, it's not necessarily easy to get to. Probably you could take a train in Chattanooga and take a car out, but it wasn't New York City.
No.
Telegraph operators were brought in. They worked feverishly during the trial, sending out apparently 150,000 words per day,
which is pretty amazing. And also, I mean, there were journalists. It's because of journalists that we have the transcript, correct?
Right.
Normally, they don't take a transcript. Well, maybe they did. Is there a stenographer? But
I don't know that. We don't know that. Right. Yeah. Obviously, there didn't need to be.
But I mean, for the good news for historians is there was so much attention to this that it really was sort of well preserved as an event, so we can study it really carefully.
Yeah, in fact, WGN, that major Chicago radio station, broadcast live from the trial itself. Now, this is not to say it broadcast the trial itself, but it broadcast live while the trial was going on, and that's the first time that had happened.
Right. Yeah, keep in mind this is
in a criminal trial.
Radio is, in 1925, essentially 5 years old in the United States.
That's amazing.
Right. If 1920 is the first KDKA broadcast the election results, the presidential election 1920. So it's still an infant medium, but it's catching on very, very quickly.
And it obviously spread enough that WGN was able to claim that it was the one who's broadcasting this across the country.
That's right. And, you know, the hype and the notoriety of the trial is also partly ensured by the famous contributions of H.L. Mencken.
Ah, yes.
Who, probably one of the most famous newspaper commentators of the 20th century, known for his sort of acidic commentary. And partly in this case because of just his open partisanship. I mean, he is openly sort of pro, as he would say, pro-reason, pro-science. He's very urban, looks down his nose at, quote-unquote, I don't know if you use the term, but bumpkins, essentially, or yokels. He has no time for what he sees as the uneducated Bible thumpers, and he basically dispenses all sorts of commentary along these lines throughout the trial and helps make it famous.
And in fact, Buzzkillers, if you watch the movie Inherit the Wind, Gene Kelly plays a newspaper man from Baltimore based on Mencken, and he's a total jerk. He's just really cynical and very anti.
Yeah, no, he was not a nice man.
very anti-Tennessee and very anti-rural and very anti-fundamental.
Right, right. And he's the one from whom we get the term a monkey trial, by the way.
Oh, Mencken comes up with monkey
trial.
That's right. Okay, okay, okay.
Yep.
Well, all this attention certainly brought much needed revenue to town, right? All these people are coming in,
mm-hmm.
Reporters, all the teams of lawyers, and there were also what we call sideshow entertainers.
Right. And you actually see this a lot during this age. One example that comes to mind a few years later is the Lindbergh baby kidnapping trial, where Charles Lindbergh's infant son is kidnapped and turns out killed. And when they think they get their man, there's a big trial, which I think in some ways is even more notorious than this one. And outside the courtroom, I remember this, someone is selling souvenir kidnap ladders. Because a ladder was used to abduct the kid from the second story baby's room of the Lindbergh house. So, I mean, and I always have to remind myself of this, you know, when you look around yourself at today, you see, wow, we're so crass and commercial and there are no standards. If you go back in history, they have nothing on us. They really don't.
Yeah. And in fact, there were people bringing in chimpanzees and dressed them up in suits and there were people
writing songs and
It was, in fact, the civic leaders of Dayton, they got part of their wish. They got all this sort of media attention. They got all this hucksterism and all this circus attention. But for them, that was the limit of it. Didn't bring a lot of tourists in. They thought that lots of people were going to come from far and wide. But I guess one of the ways in which they're thinking about this was limited is if it's being broadcast by WGN, you can sit at home and listen to it. You don't have to travel to Dayton, Tennessee. So there's this huge publicity on the one hand, but it's also intensely local on the other hand.
That's right. And unless anyone think I was surprised by this too, because I maybe not in the movie, but elsewhere, I think that because this is seen as a symbolic clash of worlds, you might think that some of the townspeople, if they're fundamentalist Christians, that maybe they don't like all this attention or they don't like all these outsiders and northerners coming in. On the contrary, apparently they were at least to some level sort of down with the project.
They
apparently were very welcoming to all the visitors, which it must have been a pretty big intrusion, right? And sort of physically.
If there are 6,000 people in the town and then 2,000 national newspapers send a reporter. 2,000, listen to me. 200, I'm hyping it myself.
But lots of other people. It's not just the 200.
200 reporters plus all of the, you know, this would, I don't know how many hotels they had in town, but it would have put a strain on the bed and breakfast industry.
Right. And if you're a local, you know, now you have to wait in line for things, presumably, at the grocery store or you can't get a table at the restaurant. I mean, it's a mixed blessing, I'm sure. And yet, apparently, they were, the theme was Southern hospitality.
Right.
Essentially.
There are a few references to that, very slight, in the film where you'll have townspeople sort of sniping at Darrow, the Spencer Tracy character, or protesting against him and then whispering onto the side to him, "Hey, if you need a nice meal, my little cafe is the best place to come, and I'll give."
Basically,
you
showing them as duplicitous.
Yeah, yeah. The movie is very much anti, you know, Daytonites. The town in the movie is called Hillsborough, and the local populace is seen as a bunch of hicks.
Well, and I also assume that, you know, if I'm living in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925 and I become aware of the writings of H.L. Mencken, I'm not going to take that very nicely or very kindly, right? I mean, he's sort of denigrating me and everything I stand for, and I don't appreciate it.
But although it seems to me, granted, one of the problems with this case and the sort of the hoopla surrounding the case is we don't have a lot of evidence of what a lot of, if you will, ordinary people thought. We don't even have a lot of evidence about what the ministers and the preachers in Dayton thought. They didn't
write.
They may have preached about it, but they certainly didn't leave any records or write letters to the newspaper or anything like that. So all we really have are kind of these outsiders' view of what is going on.
Right, exactly. I mean, like anyone else in the United States in 1925, most local people in Dayton presumably are not keeping sort of politically minded journals or diaries that we can look at.
That's right.
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 Yeah. And so, yeah, so it's all going to be this sort of much more detached or remote outsider view.
Okay. Well, and as we said before, as we said in the beginning, the upshot of the trial is that Scopes gets convicted. He gets fined $100, right? Which is, you know, what, $1,500, $2,000 now?
Oh, more than that. But who's counting? It's not. I mean, it's not. It wouldn't destroy him.
No, it wouldn't destroy him. And anyway, I'm sure that, again, we don't want to start the myth machine running, but I'm sure that the city fathers had sort of said to him on the side, you know, if you end up getting fined, you know,
right,
we'll pass the hat.
Right.
But it didn't matter because the conviction was overturned on appeal.
On a technicality.
Yeah. And then Scopes himself kind of leaves town and goes off and does graduate work in geology at the University of Illinois, becomes an engineer in the gas and oil business, goes all around the country, and eventually retires to Louisiana and died in 1970.
Right.
Within
a long time in obscurity.
That's right. He lives almost the rest of his life in obscurity. But the trial did not live in obscurity. What happens, you know, after, of course, World War II, the Depression, World War II takeover.
Sure.
But what happens after that?
Yeah, in 1955, the play by Jerome Lawrence and Robert Edwin Lee, or Robert E. Lee,
yes,
of all names.
Yeah.
They published their play Inherit the Wind, which, five years later, I believe, is turned into a motion picture.
Right.
And then it takes on a life of its own. And I think still a lot of people get their sort of sense of the trial and its importance from the movie and the play.
I did.
Right.
And I'm sure almost all the buzzkillers did. I even think people like my parents did.
Now, I'm trying to remember, did the movie sort of depict fundamentalist religion as having suffered a clear defeat in the trial?
No, it clearly depicts... Well, in a way, it clearly depicts that defeat because the Brian character, played by Frederick March, has a kind of collapse. And at the end, he's defeated by Darrow in this famous exchange.
Right. He loses the argument, essentially.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And then...
And he does actually die shortly thereafter.
In the movie. He dies. Right. He has a heart attack that night and then dies.
Yes,
now, that's not what happened in real life.
Right. In real life, he dies later.
Yeah. But so in a way, the movie is saying... You know, by the Brian character dying, you know, that this is the past. This has now left us. Science has triumphed, even if this little backwards town's court system has convicted this poor man.
Right.
Ultimately, the bigger issue and the bigger figure is now off the stage.
Right. Which is interesting to me because, I mean, to the extent that that's true, it's ironic because it's my understanding that most of the states that passed anti-evolution laws of one kind or another happens after the trial. I'm assuming in large part because of the trial.
Right.
In other words, I can imagine in some sort of more conservative states looking at this and saying, well, we're not going to have any of that nonsense here. We're just going to ban the teaching of that, and we'll do that too. Mostly in the South.
Yeah.
And there is this interesting sort of regional aspect to it at that time. But as late as the mid-1960s, there are still three states with anti-evolution statutes in place. So obviously, I think the number after 1925 is it's over 20 states introduce anti-evolution bills.
Holy cow. Well, that just can't be the South, and there must have been some other...
Right, exactly. But, I mean, these days, you know, and there's still, in one form or another, an anti-evolution movement in the country.
Absolutely.
Which is still controversial and still gets attention. But it's much more nationwide.
Right.
And there's been scholarship on these sort of the anti-evolution movement, and I was interested to learn, for example, that it's relatively recent. It only starts around 1910, 1915, so in other words, long after... Darwin
publishes this in 1860.
That's right.
Yeah.
But once again, like I said before, by this point, it's starting to show up in public schools.
Right.
You see an anti-evolution movement, but at first it's a heavily northern movement.
Oh, no.
And its leaders in the early days, 1910, 1915, they are much more sort of conciliatory. Their attitude, as I understand it, is basically we can work this out. We can, like Spencer Tracy did in the movie, we can square these two things, religion and science. But by the 1920s, it has become much more southern, much more fundamentalist, much more uncompromising. So it sort of morphs. And then after the trial morphs again, it becomes much more nationwide. You see, for example, strength in Southern California, of all places. It becomes much more nationwide. So in other words, if anyone looks at this as well, this trial, as a practical matter, slammed the door on fundamentalism? Absolutely not. If anything, it might have helped spur it.
That's interesting because that's what's kind of implied in the movie, that Brian is the old ways, and that has now passed. But interestingly, and Buzzkill should know this, because After all, so many of us get our impressions about that trial and the whole thing surrounding the trial from the movie Inherit the Wind, but the play and the movie weren't really about the Scopes trial.
Right.
They were about McCarthyism. Right. What's that? Why did that happen?
Right. Well, because and you see other examples of this, like Arthur Miller's The Crucible.
Yeah.
And I guess, well, we see this. I can't think of any examples, but we see this in many periods where the way you talk about the present through the past.
Okay.
And in other words, if you talk about the present as the present, it's too heavy-handed. It may not be taken the right way. People may recoil from it or reject it. Whereas if you're a little more subtle about it, maybe you can win people over. And so you write about, you know, 1955 was actually sort of the end of the McCarthy period. McCarthyism was on the downslide. He had certainly destroyed himself politically by 1955. But, you know, there is this climate of fear. This is the second Red Scare. You have, you know, people worried about are communists making our movies or teaching my kids, and you don't know who's a communist, right? They're the witch hunts. A lot of careers are destroyed. And, you know, there's this fear that sort of emotion and mob mentality will take over and sort of destroy reason and the sort of the brave individual.
Right.
And so that becomes a sort of theme of the play. And the way you get at that is through the Scopes trial.
Because that's, in a way, safer than having
exactly.
a McCarthy play and a McCarthy
exactly. No,
movie.
And great point, because that's the practical matter. If you want to comment on current society, you risk being labeled a communist if you're too direct about it.
Sure, and especially the theater world and Hollywood.
Right. People have been blacklisted. There were people who had to work under assumed names or through third parties. Like Dalton Trumbo. I want to see that movie, by the way. I hear it's good.
Oh, yes. People tell me it's very good.
But yeah, so it's a very dark time. And so you often have to be indirect in commenting on the present. But once again, then what you're doing is you're in effect distorting the past for your present purposes. And we call that presentism.
Right. And it shows, and they distort it by not showing the whole publicity stunt origins of the trial at all.
Yeah, which were not a great secret in the 1950s. As far as I understand.
No.
I mean, had you dug into this as a historian, you could have found this out.
Yeah. And presumably Mencken knew about it and all the reporters that knew about it. I mean, not that they were necessarily in on the fix, if you will, but it must have been pretty obvious when they got there.
Right.
But, you know, we have to say that the movie's perhaps the most successful thing of the whole, the most successful part of the whole Scope story, because that's the way people have perceived it so much in the public mind.
Right.
Spencer Tracy versus Frederick March.
And if the goal was to put Dayton, Tennessee on the map, well, they succeeded pretty admirably, I'd say.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. Our perceptions of the Scopes trial have been crafted and skewed by Hollywood and by Broadway plays. But now you know the real origins of how the trial came about and the whole circus surrounding it. And we want to emphasize circus. Talk to you next week.